بشار انت تسقط عنا ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت وهالخطاب الحريه صارت على الباب ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا
بشار ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت وهالخطاب الحريه صارت.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire and The Modern Middle East, A History. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And tell me about why, James Galvin, are the Saudis, who have mountains of money and piles of arms, somehow on the losing end of this surrogate war, in the surrogate civil war, I guess, in Syria, and conversely, the Russians and the Iranians, who have been apparently conducting massive airlifts across Iraq into Syria, they seem to be holding up Bashar al-Assad.
Well, you're right. I mean, at this point, it does appear that Bashar's forces are on the offensive. They've been able to retake Homs, the Idlib, and now they've focused their attention in the south in Daraa. I'm not quite sure, however, that if we look at it in terms of why is it the Russians are winning and the Saudis are losing, that that's really going to answer our questions. The reason why, first of all, we don't know what the Saudis are really doing in terms of aid and materiel into Syria. But the forces now, the government forces, are far better equipped, far better armed. They're organized military force as opposed to the Free Syrian Army. The Free Syrian Army is hardly an army. It's a pickup force. It's a group of militias that are operating somewhat in together. But for the most part, there is really no chain of command that connects all the various units that are fighting. So there's only so much that an outside power can do to influence events such as those taking place now in Syria.
Well, speaking of an outside power influencing, the United States, who the administration keeps saying that Bashar al-Assad will fall, they apparently, Barack Obama tried interceding with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to block the Iranian transport flights to Syria. Apparently, they've been flying record amounts of material out, they fly across Iraq, Obama's not being able to get the Iraqis help out, which I guess just makes you realize how George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, and all the neoconservatives should be put on trial in this country for their utter stupidity.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We can actually look at the decline of America in the region and the emergence of Iran as a regional hegemon in terms of 2003 when we invaded Iraq. There had been a balance of power that the United States had encouraged during the 1970s, 80s, all the way up between Iraq and Iran. As a matter of fact, during the Iran-Iraq War, the United States shared intelligence with Iraq in order to hold Iran back. What we did was we collapsed a very, very strong, ruthless, but very, very strong dictatorship in Iraq and replaced it with an extraordinarily weak government that's incapable of even ruling its own territory. So not only does it not pose a threat to Iran, but it also poses an opportunity to Iran. Iran itself is able to meddle into Iraqi affairs like it never had before.
So my understanding is that you know, there have been these bombings in Damascus yesterday and in Aleppo today. There was also apparently a busload of pro-Iranian militia, pro-Iranian Palestinians militia were also killed and targeted. It's difficult to know whether who this is. You know, could be the regime itself. Not in the case of blowing up the busload of Palestinians, but it could be the Saudis or some effort to try and shore up the opposition. The morale of the opposition has got to be pretty low. Apparently, they've been driven out of Syria into Turkey largely. I'm hearing now that the Saudis have put pressure on the Jordanians to open up arms trafficking. I'm just surprised that for all of the alleged arms and the support that was coming in from Saudi and Qatar, which we'd heard about previously, it doesn't seem like it amounted to much, and certainly nothing much in the way of anti-tank weapons, which you'd imagine. Of course, the Saudis would have plenty of that.
You raise a number of very interesting points. First, about the explosions that have taken place recently in Damascus and Aleppo. We really don't know who is behind it. It could be any one of a number of culprits. And I'm in touch with people, and they are pointing fingers in all sorts of directions. There is even rumors about al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-type jihadi groups, like the Jabhat, for example, the front for the defense of the Syrian people that has emerged recently, since January, which is a jihadi group. You also have the Free Syrian Army. You have the regime itself that, has been accused by the opposition of manufacturing these incidents. So we really don't know who is behind it. In terms of the Saudis and their capabilities, I addressed that before, but there is something else that I think is very, very important for us to understand. We should be careful what we're asking for here. The last time that the Saudis actually did massive amounts of assistance, military assistance, to a group fighting, and in this case, it's ironic, again, the Russians, was in Afghanistan, and look what we got out of that. We got al-Qaeda out of that. The problem is, exactly, do we really want the export of Wahhabi ideology and Wahhabi groups into Syria? Do we really want Saudi Arabia to cozy up even further in terms of the Syrian population, and particularly with the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria? Do we really want to create this increasingly as a sectarian conflict? This did not begin as a sectarian conflict way back when, about a year ago when it actually began. It was an intersectarian conflict. It was a population against the regime. There was all sorts of intersectarian alliances that were built. But slowly over time, what has gone on has been the protracted nature of the rebellion and the level of state violence on the one hand, and the identification of the regime with the minority community, the Alawite community, on the other hand, has made this into a sectarian conflict. Saudi Arabia moving in, Qatar moving in, both these governments, for example, have supported very, very strongly the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists in Egypt and in Tunisia, the Ennahda party in Tunisia. Do we really want further Saudi assistance? Then there's something else that we also have to take into consideration, which is the way Libya turned out. We started out with this idea of we'll have a no-fly zone. And one of my colleagues very, very astutely pointed out that the bottom line in foreign policy has to be the Hippocratic Oath. It has to be first do no harm. What we did was we created a situation that actually escalated the level of violence taking place in Libya. And again, do we really want to see the same sort of thing going on in Syria? I realize that our hearts go out to the opposition at this point. There's no doubt about the worthiness of overthrowing Bashar al-Assad. But on the other hand, the level of bloodshed now that is escalating on a daily basis, how much do we really want to contribute to that?
Well, there's no question that in terms of what the Syrian regime is doing, it's even arrested now the opposition leaders of opposition, the leaders that were calling for a dialogue, the kind of semi-official opposition. They've arrested one of their leaders, and my understanding is that There are even reports of all the Russian defense minister, Alexei Antonov, the deputy defense minister, denied accusations that Russian special forces were operating in Syria. But apparently these new Pantsir interceptor batteries that the Russians have sold the Syrians are being manned by Russians, allegedly to train the Syrians. But that's apparently what General Martin Dempsey was referring to recently in the before the Senate, when John McCain was saying we want to go in there and bomb them and create air corridors and do what we did in Libya, as you were just pointing out. Dempsey was referring to these new sophisticated Syrian air defenses. Apparently they've been shielding these flights of Iranian planes. So in the point's well taken about be careful what you wish for in terms of Saudi aid. But on the other hand, if you look at the what was just revealed from these leaked emails from the Assad's family that CNN have gotten hold of, apart from the dictator's wife ordering shoes from London worth thousands of dollars, she's also it's pretty clear the extent to which the Assad regime is completely reliant on the Iranians.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, what really fascinated me about the emails actually was the bad taste in 80s music more than anything else. But you're absolutely right in what you pinpoint in terms of the emails. The other thing that you said was absolutely spot on, which is that this is being perceived as a proxy war. The Saudis are not involved in this because they are friends of democracy and human rights, and they want to see democracy and human rights flourish in Syria. The Saudis are involved in this because they see now that, number one, the opposition is not giving up. It has lasted now for close to a year, one day actually under a year in terms of the uprising. They see it as a chance to weaken the Iranian position that had been so strong. And with the Iranians also perceive Syria as being critical as well for a variety of reasons. It's not just that they have a friend in Syria. It's that they have a friend in Hezbollah as well, and Syria is critical. Using Syria is critical for their maintenance of Hezbollah. The uprising so far has had one interesting casualty for Iran, which is that the Iranians had been a major backer of Hamas. And what looks like now is that Hamas has switched sides. It's left Damascus. It's either going to end up in Cairo or Doha. And its finances are no longer going to be in Iranian hands. It's going to be in Qatari hands. So there has been a switch that's taken place. And what we see is this proxy war is being fought out not only in Syria, but it's being fought out in various other places as well. Bahrain, for example, was a very good example of that, where the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates actually invaded to make sure that what they perceived to be a Shi'i-dominated opposition force is not going to take power in Bahrain. And just to remind your listeners that Bahrain is vastly majority Shi'i.
Sure.
And well, it's also taking place in Yemen.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, James Galvin.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria and the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire and the Modern Middle East, A History. This has been a Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons and assistant producer Nicholas Walrath. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.